You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. My name is Aaron Klein. I'm a senior fellow in economic studies here at the Brookings Center on Regulation and Markets. And it's my privilege to welcome everybody here to what I think will be a fascinating conversation on what the right role is for the Securities and Exchange Commission in dealing with ESG investing. With us today is Commissioner Hester Pierce. Commissioner Pierce was appointed to the SEC and was sworn in January 2018. This was a wonderful thing for somebody with a tremendous amount of experience, having worked as a staff attorney at the SEC, in the Division of Investment Management, having worked as counsel to former Commissioner Paul Atkins, having served as senior counsel on the U.S. Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. Commissioner Pierce has a wealth of expertise and a wealth of knowledge on the subject matter. After we hear from the commissioner, we're going to hear from a distinguished panel of experts who are going to react to the commissioner's speech, moderated by the great Lorraine Wohlert from Politico. But before turning to Commissioner Pierce, in finalizing the introduction, I want to welcome her back to Brookings, to the Center on Regulation and Markets, where among her many accomplishments, she was one of the original contributors to the Center on Regulation and Markets financial regulatory column. This was back when she was a researcher and a fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason. And, you know, Brookings, we welcome you back, Commissioner Pierce. We congratulate you on your very successful career post what I think, you know, was arguably the highlight of it all, the pieces that you submitted for Brookings, because we're committed here to having an open and honest and intellectual dialogue from all points of view who think deeply about subjects and use research and data to guide their opinion. So with that, Commissioner Pierce, let me turn over the floor, welcoming you back to Brookings and thanking you for your contributions here and your contributions as a distinguished public servant.
Well, thank you, Aaron, for that nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you all at Brookings today. I will say the highlight of my career was when I got to work with you on the Senate Banking Committee. So I think you better be calling me Hester, not Commissioner. This summer was the summer of the cicadas. The dull hum of their song permeated the solitude of an evening stroll, along with the disconcerting crunch as pedestrian attempts to avoid squashing the creatures inevitably failed. Every 17 years, the beady-eyed cicadas emerge from underground, a natural wonder, perhaps therefore to be forgiven for their uncouth habits and off-putting appearance. Cicadas arrive on schedule and behave with a comfortable predictability. 18th century farmer and self-taught naturalist and multiple cicada observer Benjamin Banneker feared, when meeting them for the first time at 17, that they would devastate the crops, so he tried to kill as many as possible. On their second time through, though, he had more sense than to endeavor to destroy them, knowing that they were not so pernicious to the fruit of the earth as I did imagine they would be. He had learned their patterns and was able to measure their schedule and their activity. People like predictable and measurable things that we can quantify, standardize, and compare with one another. This tendency is evident in another phenomenon of this summer season, the loud calls for ESG rulemaking. People want hard data to allow apples to apples comparison. This natural desire for ESG certainty, however, runs into the many real life uncertainties and complications that would characterize rule writing for the overflowing ESG bucket. Before I go there, however, I have to give you my standard disclaimer, which is that the views that I represent are my own and not necessarily those of the SEC or my fellow commissioners. Now, what I wanna do today is lay out 10 theses without a lot of sugarcoating, precisely because I want to spark a textured conversation about the complexities and consequences of a potential ESG rulemaking. Thesis one, ESG as a category of topics is ill-suited and perhaps inherently antithetical to the establishment of clear boundaries and internal cohesion. Some issues, of course, are clearly ESG, such as carbon emissions, employee turnover, and dual class shares. But many other issues are ESG only in the eye of the beholder. Some of what we're excitedly calling ESG, of course, is simply the same old stuff on which companies have been reporting in accordance with their existing principles-based, materiality-oriented regulatory framework for years. ESG readily expands, though, to include whatever the speaker or the news media are focused on at the moment. ESG's lack of a coherent unifying principle plays out in interesting ways. A recent Wall Street Journal article gave the example of a European company that's seeking to get a break on its interest rate for meeting certain ESG targets for increasing both women in management and the use of recycled plastic. Not only are women being treated as interchangeable with one another for ESG purposes, but women are being treated as interchangeable with recycled plastic, offense taken on both accounts. The point is, though, that figuring out how to deal with ESG from a disclosure standpoint is complicated by the great and growing number of unrelated and really difficult to compare items that it encompasses. Thesis two, many ESG issues lack a clear tie to financial materiality and therefore don't warrant inclusion in SEC mandated disclosure. Many proponents of an ESG disclosure framework insist that materiality is an appropriate restraint, and some point to academic studies that show that ESG items are financially material. That position begs the question of where our current materiality standard and the enforcement regime that backs it up are missing the mark. The realization that many ESG items may not be material to the issuer making the disclosure has led Europe to embrace a concept called double materiality, in which the materiality of an item can turn on its effects on environment and society. And some commenters would like the SEC to adopt a similar approach or just to throw materiality out altogether. But materiality matters. The Commission has looked to that as our guiding principle when crafting disclosure requirements because it's an objective standard by which we can exercise our statutory authority to decide what's necessary or appropriate in the public interest or for the protection of investors. If we want to mandate that issuers provide investors with information that doesn't contribute to assessing the prospect for investment returns, we better think about what it will cost them. Thesis three, the biggest ESG advocates are not investors, but a group called stakeholders. Like ESG, stakeholders is a malleable term. It can encompass an issuer's employees, neighbors, customers, suppliers, and regulators. As important as these groups are to issuers, they are not at the heart of the SEC's mission. Many non-investors have tried to repurpose the SEC's investor-oriented disclosure tool to get information of interest to them and ultimately to shame issuers into changing their behavior. Take, for example, the pay ratio rule and the conflict minerals rule. Individual and institutional advocates of ESG-related causes have drawn inspiration from these limited experiments of the past. But investors stand to lose if executives' and managers' accountability to shareholders for financial performance is replaced with accountability to an amorphous group of stakeholders. Some of the loudest voices in favor of ESG disclosures for issuers are asset managers. The fact that they work for investors does not make them investors, and they have interests that may compete with those of their clients, including generating fees and their own public reputations. Mandating the disclosure of ESG metrics could provide agents, whether corporate officers or fund managers, with an out if their performance lags. Thesis four, ESG rulemaking is high stakes because so many people stand to gain from it. Any SEC rule can create money-making opportunities, but the potential breadth and novelty of ESG issues makes an ESG rule a particularly lucrative one, and thus may make it hard for us to get objective input. The ESG consultants, standard setters, and raters who are now making a lot of money in producing, seeking to standardize and assessing voluntary disclosures have an incentive to ensure that whatever rule gets written keeps that money flowing to them. To achieve their objective of benefiting themselves and harming competitors, companies in their lobbying efforts around the rule may make joint cause with publicly popular issue advocacy groups in a bootlegger and Baptist style. Asset managers stand to benefit financially from rules imposed on public companies, which diminishes the amount of legwork they have to do to get the information they want for their ESG funds. One wonders, when the rule goes into effect, will those asset managers respond by lowering the fees they charge for their ESG funds? Thesis five, good in ESG is subjective, so writing a rule to highlight the good, the bad, and the ugly will be hard. Many rating firms exist now because people don't share uniform views of what good ESG practices are for issuers or good ESG portfolios are for asset managers. As others have pointed out, ESG rankings can differ dramatically depending on who is doing the ranking. Different ESG assessments are not surprising given that a technology, for example, can have both positive and negative climate effects. And something that may be good for the climate may be bad from a social perspective or even according to other measures of environmental harm. Figuring out what metrics to include to satisfy different views of what matters from an ESG perspective will be difficult. Thesis six, an ESG rulemaking cannot resolve the many debates around ESG models, methodologies, and metrics. Because ESG models, methodologies, and metrics involve a lot of assumptions and uncertainties, issuers take different approaches to reporting. There's not a consensus among investors on which framework should be used to report key metrics. Even assessing an issuer's exposure to climate change is difficult. Models rely on assumptions about many things, including economic activity, technological development, consumer preferences, regulatory policy, natural events, such as volcanic eruptions, and human adaptation. Further difficulties arise from extrapolating from climate models, which are global and long-term, to understand how a particular issuer will be affected in the shorter term and in the location where that issuer is located. The SEC is not particularly well-suited to make judgments about which climate metrics should be reported by whom. Agencies like the EPA, authorized by Congress to act in these areas and actually acting in these areas, are better at making these judgments and indeed are already doing so. Metrics give us something to hang our hats on, but what's the point of metrics in which we cannot have confidence? If the goal is comparability, reliability, and accuracy, codifying rough directional estimates, as some would have us do, wouldn't accomplish that goal. Thesis seven, emotions around ESG issues may push us to write rules outside of our area of authority. Conversations about ESG matters are, and particularly those related to climate, are threaded with fear, guilt, and despair born of real concern for the planet, animals, plants, and people. Emotions, though, are a poor guide to problem solving. Remember Mr. Banneker's initial reaction to the cicadas. It was fear. Who wouldn't fear the worst when such a swarm of massive insects showed up? But his initial fears of devastation proved unfounded. He realized all the cicadas wanted to do was to sing us a song as they looked for love. Thesis eight, ESG issues are inherently political, which means that an ESG rulemaking could drag the SEC and issuers into territory that's best left to political and civil society institutions. Congress and state legislatures, with their direct accountability to the American people, and civil society institutions are the proper venues for deciding political and social issues, which many ESG issues are. To date, Congress has not granted authority to the SEC to address ESG issues for the purpose of promoting goals unrelated to the federal securities laws. Serious democratic legitimacy concerns arise when an independent agency expands its own authority. These concerns increase significantly when, as some people suggest we do, the agency delegates to one or more unaccountable third-party standard setters the authority to establish disclosure requirements for an ever-expanding list of politically and socially sensitive subject matters. Thesis nine, ESG disclosure requirements may direct capital flows to favored industry in a way that runs counter to our historically agnostic approach. Directing capital flows to green uses is unabashedly at the heart of international ESG standard-setting efforts, and many want us to follow suit. That role would be a new one for an agency that is focused not on deciding where capital should go, but on making the disclosure available and allowing investors to make that decision. Thesis 10, And ESG rulemaking could play a role in undermining financial and economic stability. ESG disclosure is, as I just mentioned, a part of a broader government plan to starve certain industries of capital and feed capital to favored industries and companies. The entire 20th century teaches us that centralized capital allocation does not work, and there's no reason to think that centrally developed ESG metrics, even if comparable, reliable, and accurate, and that's a big if, will be the exception. The growing global concentration of capital in certain sectors or issuers deemed to be green could destabilize the financial system. Lots of money will be mandated to chase green investment opportunities. As with past regulatory efforts to drive investment toward particular sectors, current efforts to green the financial system could precipitate future financial instability. Many of the potentially large unintended consequences of the greening of capital flows that ESG disclosures will help to drive are likely to be borne by people who can least afford it. Economically disadvantaged communities in the U.S. and internationally could experience economic hardship as a result of this shift in capital flows. Instead of a prescriptive ESG rulemaking, we could work within our existing regulatory framework. We could put out updated guidance to help issuers think through how the existing disclosure regime already reaches many ESG topics and to address frequently asked questions that arise in connection with the application of the existing disclosure regime. We also might consider whether we can give any commission-level comfort about forward-looking statements. And we can work with investment advisors using ESG strategies and products to ensure that investors know what they're getting. There's a lot of talk these days about 2030 and 2050 emissions targets, but my target is for 2038 when the cicadas return. I hope that they'll find, thanks to wise policy choices that enable, rather than stifle, free capital flows and the free exercise of human ingenuity, a world that is greener, cleaner, healthier, and more prosperous than the one their forebears saw in 2021. In that world in 2038, perhaps even the chocolate-covered cicadas will be net zero carbon. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Pierce. It's a fantastic frame. I'm very drawn. This is cicada summer, and I think that's a wonderful way to think about the world in a discrete prime number context, even if I disagree with a lot of your conclusions. Let me push back on a couple of these theses, time permitting. I don't think we'll get to all 10. There's a thoughtful piece written by the former domestic Undersecretary of Domestic Finance in the Bush administration, Peter Fisher, coupling on a bipartisan basis with Joseph Stiglitz, a former CEA member for President Clinton. And they write, and I quote, "To protect investors and to promote efficient capital markets, the SEC needs to establish minimum standards for carbon-related disclosures," end quote. They go on to talk about how many of the assets under management are said to be sustainable, concerns about greenwashing, and they specifically address your concerns about the SEC. And they say that, and I'm going to quote one time, without such a requirement, firms are unlikely to disclose all relevant information. It is insufficient because shareholders also need a baseline of factual information consistently disclosed across time in order to estimate the value of their investments as conditions change. Investors need companies to make comparable disclosures in order to assess the relative value of different investments. Only with consistency across time and comparability among alternatives can investors assess for themselves the value of a firm and be reasonably protected against being misled. Only by the SEC setting minimum standards can we obtain comparability. I'd like you to address that comment and critique as it relates to both your positions, as well as kind of an unstated push on your thesis 10, that a risk to financial stability comes from the failure of the SEC to act and to set material disclosures that investors can compare, lest investors be looking at Enron and WorldCom type statements as they're making their decisions. How would you respond to former Undersecretary Fisher and Mr. Stiglitz's points?
There's certainly a lot in that question, Aaron. I think to start out with, I'd say, look, we have been dealing with a whole range of disclosure issues for our entire life as a regulatory agency. And the approach that we've taken is one that is a principles-based approach that generally avoids specific metrics for specific items, and instead says to companies, you need to present to investors a picture of your company through your eyes. What are you thinking about as you think about the financial future of the company? And that approach has worked quite well. Now, I understand that there's a lot of interest now in not only financial metrics, but in some of these climate type metrics like carbon emissions. And there's certainly a lot going on in the private sector in terms of setting standards, trying to help issuers think through how they might disclose that. And investors and issuers can work together in different industries to figure out different approaches. But there's not a settled approach. And some of these things, I mean, you think about greenhouse gas emissions, scope 1, 2, and 3. There's some agreement around scope 1 and 2. Scope 3 is much more difficult. And so a lot of this is being worked out. And I think if we were to come in and say, here's how you've got to do it, we would be, one, making judgments about, you know, among the different approaches that are out there and choosing one that we think would work, which may not end up being the right one. So we may end up putting out data that's bad data, and it may not be comparable across time, because presumably as we get better at measuring these kinds of things, we will refresh that approach. So you might not be able to compare 1 year to the next. And frankly, implementation by different issuers is likely to lead to differences anyway. We see that even with very standardized financial reporting issues. It's hard to keep issuers queuing to a standard that's comparable across all companies. So I think it sounds great, but I think we're really overestimating our ability as a regulator. But I think even if we're talking about society as a whole, I don't think there's anyone who can figure out how to get standardized data in this area. It's still a developing area. And then to your last point about financial stability, I mean, I think that is certainly a concern that I hear expressed a lot. And I think it's one that a lot of financial regulators are thinking a lot about, is the exposure of different industries to climate change, the physical risks, as well as transition risks as regulators clamp down on carbon emissions or certain industries that are big carbon emitters. Are companies taking that into account? And is that then, if they're not, are those risks then hiding in the financial system in a way that could really be devastating to the financial system? And my argument would be, it's better to have a heterogeneous approach where banks and insurance companies and securities investors who are investing through the capital markets are having conversations with and thinking about these things, but not having one list of companies or industries or sectors that are green and another that's brown, and having everyone run toward the green and away from the brown. I think we're much more likely to see instability that comes from that massive shift of capital. And frankly, I think we're much more likely to see Enron type or WorldCom type failures as people rush to throw their money at companies that they think are green, which may be very willing to take the money to do things, to do nothing green or nothing at all, but just to run away with the money. So I think that I get the concerns, and I think there are things that we have to be thinking about. These are a new set of risks that we're thinking about, but we also have to think about what the consequences of flooding money into purportedly green investments will do for the long term.
Rod, it would be amazing if we had a market where equity investors were being driven on long-term fundamentals or questions about corporate benefits and not on millisecond front running of high frequency trading. But that's a subject for—
That'll take us to a different topic altogether, Aaron, but I'm happy to go there.
We only have a few minutes left. I'm eager to get to the panel. I do feel that I have to respond that, you know, one of the great regulatory failures of this century, in fact, frankly, of this nation, was when the Federal Reserve sat on its hands after Congress required by law regulation on subprime mortgages in 1994. And the Fed had the idea, no need to do that. The market will take care of itself, and didn't issue any regulations on subprime mortgages until 2007. And oops, something happened during that time period. Thank you very much, Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan. Let me turn and ask you to respond to a comment that came from one of our panelists, the Managed Funds Association. They wrote, and I'd like to quote them, that we encourage the Commission to play a leadership role internationally to seek globally consistent standards that are compatible with U.S. disclosure regime. Commissioner, does the SEC run a risk? Because Europe is going ahead with this. Whatever you may decide or think about what Europe's doing, I think it's fair we could agree they're moving forward on this. And if the SEC doesn't move forward to as well, we're going to be an international laggard, and we will not be in a position to seek global consensus if we follow your approach. So how would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think this ties to the comment you just made, which is that, you know, sometimes regulators miss things. And I think that's absolutely true. And sometimes they build into their rules requirements that end up actually increasing the likelihood of a financial crisis because they favor capital going to a particular industry or they favor particular kinds of products that end up being dangerous products for the financial system. So I think we have to sometimes look at the regulatory routes as well. But I think that that's probably a longer debate too. In terms of international consistency, that's a concern that we hear from lots of asset managers who are trying to manage money on both sides of the Atlantic. And they are feeling pressure. And frankly, it's in Asia as well. They're feeling pressure to have a consistent global set of standards. And I understand that pressure, but I don't think it's bad to be a laggard when what you're lagging is an unwise policy choice that's going to drive economic and financial instability. And that's what I think is happening in Europe.
Well, it's definitely a fair comment that we were a laggard in Basel adoption, thanks to the FDIC pushing back on the Fed, and that helped us in a banking standard. Let me ask you one final question per your comment. If you come back if we all join the next time we have a cicada summer, right? This would actually be my third cicada, or fourth cicada summer in Washington. And you look back on it and it's hotter here and the climate risks and the climate models are worse than predicted and disasters are greater. What do you think it would be the one thing that the SEC could do proactively to give investors information and to require material disclosure of hidden risks if the scenarios of climate change come to bear, say not even in the most extreme, but one standard deviation above mean projections by which in 17 and then again in 34 years, because I hope all of us here are going to last more than one cicada summer. What do you think would be the biggest benefits that the commission could do for investors to prepare themselves?
I think if we keep doing what it is that we already do, which is regulate the system in a way that requires issuers to think about their risks, to think about their opportunities that result from all kinds of things. And I think climate is one of those things. I mean, companies have to think through a whole range of potential risks that are associated with that. And if it gets worse, then that's going to ramp up their attention to those types of risks. And they'll spend more time thinking about them. And then in turn, they'll have to convey that to their investors. And I think that's the best thing we can do is just stick to our knitting, serving as a disclosure regulator, pursuing enforcement actions when companies don't make the disclosures that they need to make when they're emitting things that investors need to know. And then working with investment advisors to make sure that when they are selling investment products that are designed to avoid these kinds of risky companies that they are being accurate about their representations to investors.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. We really appreciate returning to Brookings to share your thoughts and wisdom on this topic and look forward to continuing this conversation all the way through to the next Cicada summer and whatever roles we may have.
Thanks so much, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Great. Well, now it's my privilege to call a distinguished panel. As I call them up, they're going to magically float into your screen. Ty Galosh is a fellow at the Duke Global Financial Markets Center, an expert who worked on Capitol Hill and you know, helped draft, among other things, the Volcker Rule into its current iteration in law. Sanjay Patnik is my colleague and the director of the Center on Regulation and Markets. He serves as a Bernard Schwartz Chair in Economic Policy Development here at Brookings, and unlike yours truly, is actually an expert in questions of environmental economics and environmental sustainability. Andrew Lowenthal is an Executive Vice President for Global Policy at the Managed Funds Association. Previously, he served in a number of roles, including of Chief of Staff to Congresswoman, actually Chairwoman, Catherine Maloney, as well as a distinguished career, having served in the Senate, having served for many other large corporations and investor advisory roles, and at the Managed Funds Association, which we quoted, had that thoughtful comment letter earlier. And last, but certainly not least, I'm going to turn this entire conversation and the rest of the event over to Lorraine Wohlert. Lorraine manages Politico's sustainability coverage, reports on ESG finance. She's covered the White House, Congress, financial services, before joining Politico from Bloomberg. She wrote about the housing collapse. And in 2008, you were embedded in the presidential campaigns of Hillary Clinton and John McCain. And man, that doesn't feel that long ago, but politically, it feels like multiple cicada cycles ago. And so, Lorraine, take it over. The event in the floor is yours.
Great. It was a political lifetime ago, 2008. Thanks so much for the introduction. And gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Let's start at the very top. And the commissioner talked about this a little bit. I mean, does the SEC have the authority to require ESG-related disclosures? Is there a question about that? Sanjay?
Sure. So I think two things that I want to unpack here. One is, I do agree that ESG oftentimes is very fuzzy, right? It is not well-defined, and we have a plethora of standards and different methodologies around the world. And so what I would argue actually for is that we should focus on the climate risk side, really on the risk to companies by climate change, and those risks are material. And I think when we look at those risks and really focus in, then a lot of the other issues that the commissioner mentioned fall away naturally. And then I do think the SEC has the authority to regulate this, because this has direct material impact on the financial performance of companies. We need to know, as investors, as customers, which companies have and face climate risk and whether they address it. And recent studies by McKinsey and others show that only a very small percentage of publicly listed firms disclose or address climate risk, even though the majority of those firms face these climate risks. And so I think if we really narrow the focus a little bit and really focus on climate change and not all the other ESG buckets that are often floating around, then I think we are on a better path to do it through the SEC.
And the SEC is, in fact, focusing on climate change now. Exactly. Ty and Andrew, what do you think?
I might go quite a bit broader, actually. So if we go back to the creation of the federal securities laws in 1933 and 34, and you go look at the congressional record that gave rise to them, they said, look, one of the great things we saw was a massive misallocation of capital. You actually heard it from Commissioner Peirce just a few minutes ago, saying, look, people, when they don't have enough and the accurate information, they invest in dumb ways. And so the whole of the federal securities laws was not merely investor protection. If you even look at the SEC's mission, it says fair, orderly, and efficient markets. Those aren't just investors pricing risk. It's also lenders pricing risk. It's also suppliers figuring out what their risk to a company are. It's what the workers are. If you've ever dealt with a worker that's trying to negotiate with their own company, you know what? They look at disclosures by companies and their financials. All of those things are what helps make companies' cost of capital, their operations, their customers. It is what drives more fair, orderly, and efficient markets. So I'm going to push back a little bit and say, those are not things that are put into an easy bucket. Those are compensation related. Those are things that are workforce related. Those are supply chain related. Those are climate change related. But we have to recognize that, as Commissioner Peirce said, look, the other stakeholders are not the heart of the SEC's mission. I would say no, absolutely not. And if you look back to 1933 and 34, they made it very clear in the record at that time that that is not the sole purpose of the federal securities laws. It's to help make capitalism work. And that only can happen with disclosure. And then you let the market participants do what they do. So this isn't centralized spending on climate change, or this isn't directing capital. It's actually saying, we're going to give you, the market participants, information with which you can direct capital.
So so materiality is also not an easy black or white concept, although maybe Supreme Court might have a different take on that. But, you know, we've struggled already with what's materiality, right? And isn't climate change, for example, just another thing that's material that should be reported? Andrew, you know, where do you come down?
I think that from our perspective in the letter that we in the letter that we did submit, that's at the heart of what we believe, which is, and I think that there's an element of these kinds of conversations, which long before the cicadas return, we're going to be kind of be laughing about, because the materiality, I believe, and I think our on behalf of our members, is going to become self-evident over time. There are two things that are going to drive that. One is the actual change in climate, if that's going to happen, and the events and the way in that changes things. And that is inevitably going to impact companies across this country in every industry. And then the second thing will be as governments change and be actually extract a cost for what they perceive. And I think climate really and carbon are the front end of this. And to be fair, the SEC's initial request in this general area is specifically on climate. And so I think they're going to go in an order of climate and then what they would call human capital / diversity. These are all very different, though, than what we have in Europe. And materiality has worked so well, I think. So we believe that the SEC robustly pushing materiality in the same way we don't, but we don't need to tell everybody exactly what they have to do. Investors rely on corporations to tell us what their tax rate is, for good, bad, or indifferent, but we don't go through and look through to determine for ourselves what the tax rate is, nor does the SEC tell the corporations how to determine for themselves what the tax rate is. They make a determination, their accountants certify that, and they're audited, and that's presented to the marketplace, and we get to use that information to value one against the other or to develop strategies. That's what we believe is the best way to think about climate, and for the SEC to take a leadership role is incredibly important. We have the largest capital markets. We have the deepest capital markets. We must lead in this space in order to preserve that, I think, for ourselves and for our own investing populace and for our own issuers. And it's very important, we believe, ultimately, that the SEC retain control of that, and that not be, to the commissioner's point, not so much that you can't delegate some authority. FASB works well, FINRA works well, the SROs work well, but for certain specific pieces, but not to outsource it to an international body or a multilateral body in which the United States would be subject to a series of rules and regulations that were developed for markets that look different than ours.
Okay, so wow, a lot to unpack there. So it sounds like everybody thinks that the SEC should be doing what it's doing right now, which is at least considering this, you know, what's happening in this space. But let's talk about Europe for just a minute. This is very complicated. They are way ahead of us. They have a very detailed taxonomy that does what the commissioner kind of alluded to. It lists like the good guys and the bad guys, right? The green and the brown. It gets down into some very finely, you know, calibrated boxes, niches. Is that, you know, Ty, Sanjay, is that the way we should be going? Or
Yeah, I appreciate it. So I think there's a couple of things, right? So one is, you know, going back to your question on materiality, because mm-hmm. that ties in here, is we actually heard the commissioner sort of use two different terms, even in just her remarks, is the term of financially material versus what's material. And what's interesting, too, is if I ask the other panelists here and frankly, the audience members, what's material? Some people would cite to a Supreme Court case that was not at all tied to what the SEC's authority is on disclosure. Right. They would cite to a Supreme Court case about proxy voting. And when there isn't a duty to disclose, do you now all of a sudden have a duty to disclose something because it'd be misleading if you didn't? And so that's very different than what the SEC can require in an SK and SX. And the reason why this is relevant is if we think about where Europe goes, Europe has an entirely different regulatory regime in the fact that it isn't tied to how you raise money. It is tied to your size and your business. So in the US, we have very, very, very large private companies and very, very large private offerings. Going back to cicadas, Enron offered billions of dollars worth of debt that's not due until 2038. What's the risk associated with that debt? What are the climate-related disclosures that are associated with that debt? Now, a purchaser for that debt, what should they have to do to assess the risk associated with that? If it's a bank, we talk about what the banking regulators should be doing about that, or what a fund should be doing. What's the climate risk to the fund? Is it a green fund if it owns that debt? So when we start unpacking what is Europe doing versus what the US is doing, look, I personally think what the US should be doing is probably what they're likely to do, which is a TCFD, what I call plus plus, which is some line item specific disclosures that are generally broadly agreed upon, plus a TCFD framework. The reason why the TCFD framework in and of itself would likely be unable to be enough is because from an investor standpoint, it's hard to be comparable because it's a lot of pros, not numbers, right? If you're an investor, you want to have numbers for comparable companies. The more text you have, the harder it is to compare, the more discretion that there is in those preparing it. So I just want to stop the filibuster here for a minute, but just note that the SEC, I think, is going to go down a TCFD plus framework. And if they don't try to line that up a little bit with Europe, we are going to lose competitiveness. One of the things we're seeing is large international investors are actually saying we are shunning U.S. investment to the extent that we cannot get disclosure related to the risks to assess our portfolios. That's in the comment file. And we have to increasingly sense
that. Yeah, I think I'll push back on that, honestly, Ty, and I'll let Sanjay come in. But I think that the idea that if we don't exercise our own, that we're going to lose Europe, what we should do is to mine what Europe has done right and then avoid all the things that they've done wrong in terms of regulation and to move forward and to exercise that. But I think that what the pressing need is that the world really can't go forward until the U.S. steps up here. And that's the pressing need. And the other thing is the free market, the wonderful thing about it is it defies everybody's ideological expectations, including those who would say that they are the biggest defenders of it, because the free market right now is demanding information, but it doesn't have to be a number. And we have to be careful to say you can't have some sort of alternative investment number metric that is different than GAAP accounting. What we want is we want to understand what the risks are. In the same way, we can look at stress testing of the banks, and that took time and took a ramp up and took socialization. There are great models, but we need to get started. What we do believe is the Managed Fund Association, we must get started. We cannot wait for the perfect. We must get started right now because too much is going to be misallocated in the absence of the commission being the only entity that can set for the nation some of these basic ideas down.
I mean, but this is a market-driven exercise at the SEC, isn't it? I mean, the investors are the ones who've been demanding these rules. Sanjay?
Exactly. And I think that's a big key here, right? We have so many different voluntary disclosures and standards by companies. It's a jungle out there. It's really difficult for an investor to cut through all these different indices and see which one is the one that actually matters. And I think exactly for that reason, we need regulatory authorities to step in and set a common standard that is uniformly applied. I think where the Europeans are really smart is that it takes a lot of administrative capacity, a lot of expertise and knowledge to put these systems in place. And they did so already with the carbon pricing system. They started in 2005, where the US is very far behind because we don't have a carbon price. And they did have the learning problems. And we're going back to your point, right? They made their mistakes, which was beneficial to the rest of the world. But in that process, they built up a lot of expertise and capacity at the regulatory agencies to actually move forward much more quickly. And I think if the US doesn't move along in the same way, we're going to lose out on that. We're not going to be able to catch up. We will lose kind of like that internet. We want some kind of harmonization, right? No company, no investor wants to deal with very different regimes in Europe and in the US, and it's not beneficial to the world economic system. So it would be good if the US coordinated more with Europe. We don't have to go exactly down the route. We don't have to go in the minutiae details that maybe the Europeans are doing, but we have to at least start trending towards them, that we can secure both our capital markets against climate risk.
And both, by the way, when we talk about costs and benefits for issuers, we also ought to be thinking about costs and benefits for all of the rest of the market participants. And again, largely investors, but also lenders, right? Bank lenders look at K's and Q's too. And so do workers, so do other executives, so do competitors for those businesses. And to the extent that they're all undertaking a lot of effort to try to compare different numbers, and they've actually had, you know, large multinational corporations in particular and sophisticated investors in particular have already developed expertise working in Europe, we actually get the benefit of that as we're developing them here. But right now, where we are, is they're spending an awful lot of time and an awful lot of money to guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, Sanjay's, you know, the idea that it's a jungle out there is completely like correct. I mean, just the acronyms in the space are driving me nuts. I can only imagine, you know, the executives trying to make sense of this. Somebody who wants to get into this space, you know, where do they even start? But let's, you know, this came up from an audience member, and Larry Fink has also brought up this concern. If we go down this path, you know, don't we start seeing some of these assets or companies going private to get out from under, you know, the ESG sort of microscope? And that does nothing for the companies or the, you know, for investors or for the climate, right? How do we fix that problem?
So,
Ty?
Oh, I'll go. Andrew, you go first.
Go ahead, Andrew.
No, I think that there is always a risk, right? And part of the balance of the risk is the continued attractiveness, depth, and liquidity of the market to go public at a cost of, at a rate and an efficiency of capital that is better than anywhere else. I do think we have to be a little careful about ascribing too much to Europe. There is no, unfortunately, see, even since they've implemented everything, there's no evidence that their markets are deeper, more liquid, or have attracted more investors than the U.S. markets over the comparable period of time. Nor do we see actually a rise in capital to those who would be like the fossil fuel. There is a mishmash because everyone's trying to do everything at once. One of the, you know, mistakes I think the Europe made was they also dumped a whole bunch of requirements on a whole series of asset managers as well, and the counting and how you count this and how you deal with this. But for example, you know, there are ideas in Europe where if you are short ExxonMobil or you are short an Enron, that would count against you simply by virtue of having a transaction. That's in the way that they're actually pushing. And this is the concern I think that we would have about multilateral standard setters for the capital markets, which are very different, where the U.S., by virtue of having 45% to 55% of the equity, global equity markets, really should be writing the dominant sets of rules and going through what are known. What will make this easier to digest for all investors is not creating new standards, new terminology, new materiality, new forms, but going through as much as possible what we know and understand so that we can digest it. It's not that hard. We have incorporated so much in our society that was unthinkable before using these very strong, robust, adaptable ideas.
Well, let's go back to the question about, you know, shifting dirty assets, Ty.
Yeah, I think it's so. First off, it's in the last several years, it used to be, frankly, from the passing of the federal securities laws until, frankly, relatively recently, the vast majority of capital raised was in public offerings in public markets. That's no longer the case. In fact, we're over 2/3 are in private equity. We've also seen, again, number of fossil fuel assets in particular have gone private. Pipelines are lots of private. You know, when we talk about the Colonial Pipeline, it's a private equity owned pipeline. We talk about a lot of fossil fuel assets in particular, but also other companies that may be more controversial or more highly regulated or more present more investor risk have a tendency to actually now access the private capital markets more regularly. So that is absolutely a concern. And one of the things I think we saw is actually the SEC is not oblivious to it. If you go back to the request put out by Acting Chair Lee on March 15th, question 14 went specifically at it. And one of the things I think we saw is folks like myself, but also, frankly, some very, very large investors, I'll use BlackRock as an example, and many others, said, hey, we need to have some sort of baseline of private disclosures, private market capital disclosures, or we are going to create this massive, exacerbate this massive burden difference between the public and private markets. Because we will, I think, start to see what I would call the bad bank or the fossil fuel assets moving there. To the extent that their cost of capital is made easier because of a lack of disclosure and an accurate assessment of pricing and related risks, particularly transition-related risks, I think that that's going to persist. So until those disclosures are made and investors and other market participants can more accurately assess those risks, that's going to happen.
So I'm still a little confused, right? I understand this trend has been happening already, but what can the SEC do, or should the SEC do anything to prevent it?
I think it's a really good question, and Larry Fink brought that up at one of the events we had in January. I do think that this is where the need comes in to have supplementary measures, right? That you actually need the EPA to come in and regulate all companies based on their emissions and not only public ones. That's what happens in Europe with the carbon market, right? It doesn't matter whether public or private. Most of the companies regulated are actually private in the emissions trading space to have this complementary effect. Otherwise, you will see a shift of capital. I think there's at least a risk.
And that isn't that at the heart then of what the Biden administration is doing with John Kerry and having a climate czar at virtually every agency? So you have coordination and Jared Bernstein. So you have coordination at the NEC, you have coordination within the White House, you have coordination within every agency. The capital markets can do a lot, but they cannot substitute for active government societal decisions that quantify some of these things that we believe are harming or costing us something. The capital markets cannot determine what a society's corporate tax rate is. We can allocate capital based upon what we understand each corporation is complying with, but the government still has to do something. European governments, world governments still have to ultimately create some of the monetization and the cost associated with carbon. Otherwise, we are all just sort of spitballing for lack of a better word.
Are you saying we need carbon pricing in the U.S.? Is that what
I don't know? That is a governmental societal decision, but the way to get at a private company is to deal with this across the board and not to only look at the SEC or the securities laws to get at it, but to say if you are a pipeline, the FERC is going to weigh your carbon emissions and your footprints in a consistent way, or the bank regulators are weighing all lending to these areas as a result of having federal depository insurance backstopping, or the EPA says X, or the Pentagon says you will not do business with us unless you have a completely electronic car fleet.
I think we do need a carbon price. I totally believe that. I mean, most economists do, right? That's the only way. And most of the world is actually moving in that direction. And so we need that as a supplementary measure to the SEC. The SEC alone and the carbon markets alone will not solve that. We need the price on carbon emissions.
Say, on the private markets, when we talk about private companies, large private companies exist exclusively, basically, at the discretion of the SEC, allowing them to be private. Most of these companies... have done offerings of securities, which 30 years ago would have made them publicly traded companies, but no longer do today. One of the things the SEC could do to actually is pull those companies back into the public markets. Mm-hmm. And that is something that's controversial because we're talking about undoing the last 35, 40 years of financial deregulation. But if you pulled those companies back into a public reporting regime, the SEC could, in fact, condition those things and say, look, we actually want to have a baseline level of disclosures if you're going to be a large private company.
Okay. We're running out of time, and I want to get to one more thing. I mean, when I was reading the comments, I mean, there are thousands of comments. And my takeaway was there was a lot of support in general, like generic support for generic disclosure. Okay. Where is the rubber going to hit the road? I mean, one fault line I think is going to be, you know, furnishing versus filing this information. Furnishing meaning I'll publish this, I'll publish my climate risk information in a nice report once a year, or filing, you know, I'll incorporate it into my 8Ks, 10Qs, whatever. Is one preferable to the other? Sanjay, why don't you kick this one off?
That's an interesting question. I do think we need both. We need to have that information and in a standardized way so that investors can compare it. And I do think firms need to file it as well. Because going back to the materiality question, I think a lot of people think, well, this is something that may be relevant in the future. Actually, it's not. It's already here. If we look at some of the impact that the extreme weather events are having on big companies all over the world, Coca-Cola, others, I mean, a couple of years ago, it was too hot in Arizona that airplanes could take off, right? Because think about that. That's a big risk for the airline industry. We should know about that if I put my money in there as an investor. So I think both of them should be required.
So that's materiality. They were disclosing these things when they became material back in, 2017 was the heat wave. Right.
But I think they have to do it proactive, right? Because a lot of with climate change, you have the uncertainty and you have the systemic risk. You have to really look at your entire company and see what are the parts that are vulnerable to different climate risks.
Okay. File or furnish, guys?
Yeah. I mean, this is relatively clear for me. Information is only as good as it's reliable. And I'm sorry, but filing is a fundamentally different set of liabilities related to it. The one thing I could say is making sure that there is sort of a little bit of flexibility to make sure that people are able to exercise their judgment and reasoned judgment supported by evidence judgment on the decisions that they make. But that's a discussion of what you disclose, not how you disclose it in your liability for what you say.
Reliability is incredibly important to our members as investors, and filing is the way to get at that. We want to be less prescriptive. But once you are liable for what you say, we believe that will drive a lot of uniformity and better answers and better data. That we trust the management to get us that once they know they're liable for saying something about how climate change is going to be there. That should be not the debate, but the rubber is going to hit the road of what they have to say, how prescriptive is it, and what is the standard setting body, whether it's a U.S. body or multilateral or delegated or the SEC itself, that does the rule.
Ty's waving his finger at you.
That is the thing. I mean, you heard it first just a minute ago, and I think reading the comment file, the thing that I was drawn to was the disputes over third-party standard setter right. Entirely, whether or not, and if so, how. And it's certainly, you know, from my perspective, it's really interesting because, you know, Commissioner Peirce and I agree on some things, but that's not usually as big of a list as what we disagree on. And this is one of the areas where I think we have a lot of agreement on what the expectations are and the accountability. Third-party standard setters, it's hard to hold them accountable for a governmental purpose. Unless you get the governance right and the funding right. And, right. You know, as it turns out, those are things that can easily go wrong here. And that's one of the challenges we have with the third-party standard setters that currently exist. They all have strengths and weaknesses, but it's also if the government is going to turn to one, establish one, you know, obviously we have the SSBs being set up. One of those things is the U.S., are the securities regulators going to try to either defer to an international one, create their own domestic one, or alternatively, try to, you know, shove this into what I would call the existing reporting regime framework of, you know, sort of FASB and other.
Well, I mean, you know, the problem is that, you know, the SEC can't, you know, well, maybe I'm wrong, correct me, but like the SEC can't build its own framework or shouldn't build its own framework. I mean, they don't have the person power, right? And I agree that the TCFD, it's like some of these organizations are sort of a black boxy a little bit, right? Just not necessarily because they're non-transparent, but nobody looks inside. So,
but you can give principles and you can give a series of things that are the elements by which you can, as the management, select the correct thing for yourself. And it is then incumbent upon the investors to do a little bit of work, Jasper is right, ourselves to be able to suss some of those things out, just like different accounting firms will approve different tax ideas and different ways of calculating taxes. Some discrepancy in the marketplace is wonderful because it is volatile. We interact. It is a beautiful expression in that way at a very elemental level. And it's okay for there to be some differentiation. We are capable of figuring that stuff out. But make them stand by what they say is critical.
Okay, interesting. Well, that's a nice way to sort of end this because I think everyone on the panel is like in agreement on this one. So listen, guys, this was really terrific. And I think we should come back and do another panel on TCFD and SASB and some of these groups. I think that would be fun conversation.
Yep. Thanks.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thanks to our audience. We appreciate you tuning in.